Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And welcome in to another episode of Turn the Corner, a Detroit Tigers podcast. I'm Kieran Steckley. With me, as always, is a man who is more angel than that one umpire named Hernandez. He is Cody Stavenhagen. How you doing?
Hey, doing good, Kieran. It feels good to finally be home for a little bit. My office up here, almost forgot what it was like. But we're back. We had a three-game homestand against the Oakland A's, and somehow the Tigers lost the three-game homestand against the Oakland A's. So we had all these good vibes, all these fun topics. Now we're right back into everyone is mad and angry. We're going to talk on this pod about trying not to ride the wave and the highs and the lows. But there's still kind of a lot to sift through, I think, big picture and small picture, given the events of the past week.
Most definitely. So why don't we go ahead and start out on a little bit of a positive note. So the team has won two series coming into the home opener. Anyway, they call it opening day, but it's always, I can't do that without, you know. So anyway.
That bothers me. Why are we calling it opening day when it's opening day in Detroit, but it's not opening day, opening day.
Yeah, so, you know, skipping past that, I'm sure people roll their eyes at that. However, it seemed like this is about as big a quote-unquote opening day as possible last couple of years, because obviously the team has had good vibes and had some wins. So take us to Thursday, Cody, for the Tiger, and an exciting game to boot. You had also Scooble on the mound. So take us to the environment a little bit for those who couldn't make it to Comerica, the environment of quote-unquote opening day in Detroit. We'll start out positively here.
Yeah, I do wonder how much the 5-1 start mattered, because it felt like maybe the busiest opening day I've experienced. It's a little bit hard to quantify because they're all busy in Detroit. They're all technically sellouts. There's a ton of media all the time. But I think in just terms of like the amount of reporters and cameras and TV people from all over the state flooding into Comerica Park, it was just busy. The press box was packed. Trying to do interviews post-game was a madhouse. It was like more people than the postseason, I feel like. Obviously, the ballpark was busy. You know, I was coming in off a crazy, you know, delayed flight and travel experience in New York, so I didn't get to get around and socialize and check out the scene before the game as much as I would have liked to, you know. But the weather wasn't great. We still got some snow flurries, but
that was,
you know, the sun was out a little bit. Like, I think the party atmosphere was alive and well. So yeah, I would almost say compared to previous years, I think this was the rowdiest it's been in a while.
Well, they got a show, you know, to cheer on. And real quick, I'm not going to let it go unmentioned. Pretty nice first pitch from our boy Panay Sewell over there.
It was really good.
Like, I was impressed by that. So, you know, everyone knows I like it when the sports kind of clash like that. So that was cool. And, you know, shout out to Blake Corum for being there today as well. So let's kind of start with a broader approach here, Cody, and then we can kind of get in some nitty-gritty stuff. Because I'll be honest with you, pretty much going into the back half of the doubleheader against the Mets, I kind of had a frame of mind that I thought we would kind of talk about today. And despite, you know, losing that game and kind of disappointing fashion, I would say, obviously. And then, you know, you get the nice up and down win on quote unquote opening day, and then obviously not really anything much to speak of on Saturday and Sunday. I was like, is it luck or is it variance kind of how these games are going? So Tigers right now are 6-3. I think if you were to poll any Tigers fan, you're 6-3 in your first 9. How do you feel? You feel pretty darn good. You feel pretty darn good knowing the schedule, knowing the limitations of this game, everything, weather, that kind of thing. Starting out 3 outdoor series, obviously going into 4 with Pittsburgh tomorrow. It's a little disappointing when you lose the 2 games into the weekend, but I think it's all kind of, I'm going to almost like steal the line from your story that, you know, as we're recording this, you basically just published. It kind of feels expected. It feels pretty expected. I don't want to say it's luck, bad luck, you know, if there is such a thing. But I think it's all kind of the expected variance of the situation. So as of now, they're 4-1, the Tigers are, in 1-score games. Obviously, that's the entire opening series and then a couple more after that. I would almost consider 5-1 if you count the extra inning game in New York when it's 0-0 through, you know, going into extras. I think you could kind of count that 1 score, even though it didn't technically amount to that, which is good. Those are good quality things, also with some variance. So you're kind of like trying to talk away both sides here, where it's like you believe in the moves of AJ, you believe in the, I don't want to say like clutch, but timely plays made by the guys on the field, but at the same time knowing that it just doesn't always work out that way, and that's baseball. So your opinion, Cody, on kind of what we're seeing here, where it's things are really tight, pitching at times is brilliant, others not, we'll get to that as well, hitting is lagging, but again, kind of expected overall. So your kind of flow of thought about like a 6-3 start, kind of the way that they've won games, and whether this should be kind of looked at as a worrisome thing or like a good thing with concern, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would lean closer toward good thing with concern. You know, I went on foul territory this week when the Tigers were still, I guess, technically undefeated, you know, and Eric Kratz hit me with the question I was not ready for. He goes, are they good? I was like, oh, well, depends how you look at it, right? The wins count. Like, that's what I was saying. Like, they have 6 wins on the board that you will take, and when you add them up at the end of the season, you will be glad you have these 6 wins. Now, what have we really learned about this team? I don't know that we've learned a lot that we didn't already expect. The pitching's pretty good. The bullpen has the capability to be really good. And the offense, at times, is going to be pretty brutal. I personally expected all of that coming into the season. And that's kind of a recipe for, I don't know, if you can have a bad offense and be 6-3, you got to be pretty happy, especially early in the year. Yeah, the weather's been bad, all that. Some of these guys are eventually going to heat up. It's going to be a concern. I've been saying it. I'm going to continue to say it. They're going to have to find a way to score more runs if they want to be legitimate playoff contenders. But hey, you were scrappy, you were fun, you found a way to win some close games. Is that like a real trait? I guess that'd be the question. Like, do you believe, oh, this ball club has character? It's like, yeah, like, I do really like the quote-unquote vibe of this club, as we joked about kind of all spring training. I don't know if they continue to play one-run games. They're not going to win them all. That's just not reality. Like I wrote, like, there's a grounder that gets through the middle, or a ball that's fair or foul, or a ball that dies at the track or goes out. That can be the difference. There can be a lot of variable, random things that determines who wins close baseball games. It helps if you have a tough and resilient and close-knit team and all that. But, you know, I've covered sports for a while now. I've covered a few different sports. Have you ever, and you have too, Karen, have you ever covered a team that wasn't resilient or didn't brand itself as resilient? Because I haven't.
Well, I never thought, never covered a team that didn't think they were. I definitely covered teams that weren't, and both of us have at the same time, well, sometimes.
So I would say this is a more resilient team than 2014 Oklahoma State men's basketball. All right.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't attach myself too big to that narrative, because at the end of the day, baseball is less about resiliency and team chemistry and more about like preventing runs on scoring runs. So.
Well, the way I kind of look at it, and this is probably, this is not analytical, and maybe it's overall kind of, I don't know, maybe it's dumb. You guys can tell me if it's dumb. The way I look at it is these traits have to present themselves for any good team. Now, whether that's quantifiable, whether like that's just kind of like an overarching thought that, like, you have to have these traits in order to be successful. Now, it probably is more to do with the teams that are good just have those traits as opposed to, like, trying to acquire them, if that makes sense. Like, the skill overtakes that kind of unmeasurable thing. But it does have to exist. And if you're a young team, like the Tigers, and you're a team that, like, I think it's fair to say they believe they can go out and win the division. Like, they've kind of said it several times in spring training. That was kind of the message after home opener. It's like they believe that this is within their grasp. So it's important to win games like that early on to try to like instill that confidence further.
Yeah, like, there's some chicken or the egg there for sure.
Yeah, it's like it's a thing in some regard. Now, the like from like a managerial standpoint, AJ has to kind of look at this a little differently. I think, like, a couple of years ago, we talked about the Tigers, like, manufacturing runs. Remember they were, the AJ's first year? Remember they were so aggressive, and it was fun. You know, that was when Badu was, you know, at the height of his powers, it seemed like, you know. Now I think it's almost like AJ, with every decision he makes, he's kind of like, you're like manufacturing wins a little bit. Like, when it's there, you have to kind of take it with a little bit extra measure, because obviously he's trying to win every game. I understand that. But when it's there, that's why Foley was used so much. It's like, hey, we can get this. Let's get it. Because if you're going to win the division, and let's just say that's the goal, if you're going to win the division, it's not going to be by 8 games, right? Like it's going to be close. Like, all of these wins are going to matter a lot if you're going to try to, like, get to that point. So that's kind of how I look at it. And then when the games aren't kind of there for the taking, you see things like we saw, like, relief decisions on Saturday and Sunday. So he sends out Joey Wentz, and he sends out Will Vest. That's it, out of the bullpen on Saturday. Now, I know travel, the double, yeah, I understand all that. And then on Sunday, obviously the game being out of hand, he sends out Fieto, and he throws in an inning at Lang because he hasn't gotten that much work to this point. I don't think those are coincidental moves, right? So I think he knows the kind of team he has. I think he knows that there are certain times to kind of push the initiative, and there are certain times not. Hell, I think that Joey Cora knows the situation and is pushing to get guys home because runs are a premium on this team right now, and sometimes it's not going to work out. But that aggressive nature kind of filters into his decisions, I would believe. So, all that to say that, yes, I agree that it is, you know, concern level is there. But the ingredients that we've seen in these 9 games are not going away. Like, how they've lost and how they've won. Either way, how they've lost and how they've won is not going away anytime soon. And on an extra macro perspective, if, let's just say, Riley Green never, like, takes another step, or Torkelson never takes another step, then all this is for naught anyway, you know, like, for the franchise in general over the next couple of years. So I think it's important to win games when you can, knowing that there are going to be droughts, pitchers are going to get hurt, stuff isn't going to, like, you got to take them when you can, more so for a team that actually does believe it could win something, or at least have a winning season. I think it was a very important 9 games. As weird as that is to say, and how they did it was a very important 9 games.
If you want some perspective, the Tigers started 2-9 last year, so we will take this start over that any day of the week. And they won some of those games despite the Joey Cora outs on the bases. Quite aggressive. You know, we've talked about that before. Do you think, Kieran, that AJ Hinch actually thought that that was a good send against the Mets when Carson Kelly got hosed by kind of a mile?
I think it's quintessential AJ Hinch that what he said is 100% what he believes, because he was talking about, like, well, the guy had to, you know, they have to make, you had to play the ball perfectly, you know, had to make the right, you know, all these kind of elements that go into throwing a guy out at home. But he also probably disagreed with the decision. Like, I think he, because he's obviously he's not going to throw any coach under the bus. But like, I think he was telling the truth. But also, like, the second part of that sentence is, but it was a bad sentence still. You know, it's kind of like, it's not, you know, I need some space, you know all those breakup lines. It's like the second half of the sentence is actually kind of the truer truth, but this is also kind of true, you know? So that's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah, we can get, I don't want to get too far in a tangent here, but we can get so many hot takes on, like, sins on the bases. And I was on a long New York City subway ride, and I was like, is there a way to quantify what's a good sin, what's a bad sin? So I got way down that rabbit hole, and it's kind of interesting. Like, the run expectancy, which is kind of the average amount of runs a team scores, runner on third, what would it be, two outs, I guess, is, you know, 0.3 something. So 0.3 runs per inning. So kind of you have a 30% chance of scoring. That's neutral, devoid of who is the pitcher, who is the batter. But kind of a way to twist that and think about it, if you simulate that play 10 times, do you think Carson Kelly is safe more than three times? And I was like, I don't know. Like, there's no way to do it. I'd say, you know, I could see the throw going up the line or down the line 2 to 4 times. So maybe in that context, it's not that bad of a send. It's not, it doesn't make it look better, but doesn't make it look as bad as maybe I first thought. Now, when you factor in Andy Ibañez was safe on a single, you actually had two runners on base. Your run expectancy was closer to, I think, 0.5. Maybe you're leaving runs on the table. And this is all kind of played out through the course of 162 games. So, like, it's, you know, in that moment, Joey Cora is saying, screw it. Like, let's score the run, which to me is kind of like, you know, if you're playing blackjack and you're in a hole and you're like, screw it, I'm going to bet $200 on this hand. It's great if you make it. It's not so great if you don't.
Maybe is this an infestation of Detroit Lions culture? Dan Campbell going for it on fourth down. Joey Cora, waving guys around third. Maybe that's the play. Maybe that's the way Detroit balls now.
So some have said the Tigers have grit.
Let's move on to another topic, Cody, that there's a word to describe it. I have yet to come up with this word. I don't know how to describe Matt Manning part 1 million because
yeah.
I was watching that game, you know, the back half of the doubleheader is 20, you know, he's the extra guy sent up from the minors, which is just a weird statement to have for Matt Manning, you know. But it worked out great that he could come up, and you could argue it's a luxury of the team right now. However, he goes 5 2/3. He doesn't allow a hit. I never really felt all that comfortable the entire time watching him. You know, like, I don't think he had no-hit stuff, quote-unquote, if you want to put it that way. And then you put out this stat. He's allowed 2 or fewer hits in his last 4 major league starts.
He's dominant. No one can touch him.
What am I supposed to do with that, Cody? And this guy got—he lost a job in the rotation, and he's 2 or less hits in his last 4 starts. And you know, I never really thought that AJ obviously was gonna like let him try to get the no hitter or whatever, and it ended up not being, you know, coming to fruition anyway. However, like, I we talked on the phone while you were waiting at LaGuardia Airport. I was like, maybe if there was a day to push it, it might have been this one, because he's technically not on your, you know, he's not on your 26 or whatever. but AJ doesn't think like that. But he said, like, no, it was the easiest decision because we got to go win the game. And that kind of plays to what I was talking about earlier. So you got to see just an odd circumstance in Matt Manning with the coming up from Toledo, pitching, you know, pitched a no-hitter, you know, through 5 2/3. And then he's back down there, and as of now, by the good graces of the baseball gods, the Tigers are pretty healthy on the pitching staff, and we don't know when we'll see him again, although we will. So I don't know. What do you make of Matt Manning after another iteration of just scratching your head about how to get around this guy?
Yeah, perplexed as ever. Some of it doesn't make sense. I mean, the reason Matt Manning didn't make the team, gives up a little bit too much loud contact, not always completely consistent with his secondary pitches. These four starts where no one's been able to hit him, he has strikeout totals of 3, 4, 1, and 3. So there are numbers that suggest last year, Matt Manning had a very low batting average on balls in play. His expected ERA was much higher than his actual ERA. There are stats that suggest he had a lot of good luck. But it seems like he just keeps having good luck because he came out and he wasn't necessarily pitch efficient. He missed a few bats, but not a ton. His stuff wasn't as sharp as we had necessarily seen in spring training. And the Mets are making contact, and it just kind of keeps going right at guys, and it doesn't stop. And I'm sitting there worried I'm going to have to catch a flight out of New York. And I'm like, all right, I really don't want a no-hitter. I'm not trying to root against anybody here, but could a ball just fall? And it just wasn't happening. So the outing itself was somewhat perplexing. I think even more interesting, I want to know what really happened in the post-game conversation between AJ and Matt, because AJ kind of goes out of his way, I thought, post-game to be like, yeah, actually, Matt wasn't that good. Obviously, that's not a direct quote, but he was, pretty firm in pointing out all the things Matt could have done better. And then Matt Manning, who I was really impressed by Matt in the demeanor he brought both before the game and after the game, given a guy in his situation. He was pretty candid with the media. He did sound like he has a good level-headed understanding of his situation. But then he kind of goes, yeah, I told him I have a lot to work on before I go face the Indianapolis Indians. And he said it in this serious tone, but it's like, dude, that was a rather pointed comment, my guy. So I thought it was awesome. Honestly, Matt Manning went up in my power rankings given that quote, but that's got to be weird. You shut down the New York Mets for 5 2/3 and you're going to face the Indianapolis Indians.
There is something to be said about how he handled the whole ordeal. And look, if we were just looking at box scores and we're like, oh, wow, so Manning came up and he didn't allow a hit. They're almost six. Like, we have to change the conversation about this pitching staff? Well, maybe we do, but not really because of that reason. Which actually leads me to another point, Cody. I want to power rank the starting pitchers, and we'll throw Manning in there right now. I want to power rank them.
And this is going to be spicy.
And I just want to iterate that this was a gut feel. Just a gut feel. I just kind of was like, how do I feel about these guys through 1 to 2 starts? I'll just go real quick in order. You can just tell me how wrong I am. And I probably am wrong. Scooble, Olsen, Mize, Manning, Flaherty, Maeda. I have Manning ahead of the two free agent signings right now. And Flaherty didn't inspire much confidence. And I probably have Maeda too low. But, like, he was bad in his first game. And he had to settle in to his second. How do you feel about that? Just kind of like a gut checklist without looking at stats, all that stuff.
Yeah, if you're just going straight context neutral, I think it's kind of tough to dispute that list. Like, Scooble's the guy. He's Scooble. Olsen's had a lot of success his last, 7, 8 major league outings. Mize was pretty good last time out. Didn't quite get the box score results. We saw what Manning did. We saw what Manning did all spring. I think the one that makes it tricky is Flaherty. Because Flaherty looked so good at times in the spring. He looked really good, I thought, his first start against the White Sox. He looked not so good against the A's. But then you look, it's like, well, he did overcome a really rough first two innings and went 6 despite just not having his fastball that day. It's going to blemish his ERA for a while, but gotta like some things he did, and Maeda was a lot better than his first outing, so I still don't feel terrible about any of those guys. I think if you know, if I were to re-rank anyone, it would probably be to put Flaherty above Manning and arguably even above Mize. We'll see how Casey and Reese pitch here these next couple games, and we'll probably change our opinions all over again.
And you know what? Shout out Casey Mize for, you know, he has this, you know, anticipated start first time in basically 2 years, and they do the thing where it's like, oh yeah, I think we're gonna be able to play, and so he's got a, you know, he's got the, I assume he's a very routine heavy guy. That's just a vibe that I get from him.
No, he is.
And so like he goes through the routine, kind of in the back of your head, knowing it's at least not gonna, you know, go according to timeline wise. And then you have to kind of do it all the next day. So shout out to him for
Casey. You know, the night of the first rainout, that he was like a, you know, a tiger in a cage. I mean, he looked so tense and like in a good way, I guess, but just ready to pitch, you know, like kind of fidgety. He's throwing a ball back and forth in his glove, and he's just kind of pacing and walking around, and I can't imagine what his emotions must have been like through that delay and then through the next day. This guy was so, you know, he even said, like, I was kind of exhausted by the end of that night because I had to keep myself ready. I was trying to stay locked in. You know, I'm sure it was kind of taxing.
Yeah, and maybe in a way it was maybe a little, now it didn't matter because there was another delay, but, like, you know, it's probably hard to go to sleep, you know? Like, you know, that's...
It must have been. I don't think we'll ever know exactly what that was like emotionally for Casey. He's very, you know, polished publicly. He's a great interview because he's candid and gives some insight, but he also, you know, I don't think he lets his emotions come out in that setting. I imagine before that game, after that game, you know, when he's talking with his wife or his parents, there must have been a lot of emotion flowing through Casey Mize. It meant a lot to him just to make it back and throw a major league game.
Sure. And, you know, a guy that was sort of like the inverse, and you basically wrote about this on The Athletic, you can read it if you're a subscriber, the inverse of sort of the Manning element, where it's like you felt a lot better about his stuff, even though, like, you know, it didn't, the results didn't necessarily follow how you felt.
If we would have been doing this pod the night after that game, all we'd be talking about is like the splitter. The splitter was back, baby. I mean, the splitter. The long-lost splitter of Casey Mize that got him drafted number one overall was pretty nasty against the New York Mets. That might be the most encouraging thing that happened this week.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, long-term health and all that stuff, like, you, I think this week kind of taught us is that, like, the value of having Casey Mize as your quote-unquote, you know, fourth or fifth, you know, whatever, you know, guy, like, it kind of makes you feel, you know, a little good, and I don't want to, like, shoot past, like, Reese Olson, you know, looking like a guy that belonged and, I guess, in my mind, was not necessarily on the chopping block in spring training. I was like, oh, yeah, that's why. You know, that's why. So, you know, credit to him there. The reason I did the power ranking thing a couple minutes ago is because I was like, I kind of feel like you probably feel better about Mize Olson than you do Maeda Flaherty right now. Like, there's certainly an argument to be made there. Now, I know it doesn't, like, matter all that much, you know, sort of like the ninth guy, though. But, like, I think you kind of feel a little bit better. And, of course, you know, they're going to pitch against Pittsburgh, the hottest team in baseball. And then, I hope this doesn't happen, but then they'll get shelled and I'll look like an idiot. So maybe that's what's destined here. But you feel good about those guys, possibly more, maybe because they're a little homegrown, but possibly more than Maeda, certainly.
I just think they've been more consistent in the stuff we've seen since the start of spring training. They've given you pretty solid stuff, pretty solid outings every time. Maeda really hasn't, and then Flaherty has a lot of times, but really just once, maybe twice, he hasn't. But he struggled enough with his stuff today that, you know, I think everyone's kind of like, okay, how's he going to bounce back in the next outing?
Well, it's kind of like the curse of the free agent signing a little bit, where it's like, oh, we brought this guy in and we didn't spend more on Montgomery or Snell, or, you know, whatever. Like, you know, how disconnected that thought process might be, it's just, it will just lend itself in that direction no matter what. All right, well, let's go to another talking point that I was like, I literally like texted you last Sunday, and I was like, should we, you know, talk about this or give it, you know, a handful more games? And it was the right decision. Yeah, we'll give it some more games. And that's Colt Keith defense. Now, I was prepared to say this anyway, and then today on X, you are at Cody Stavenhagen, and I'm at Kieran underscore Steckley, pod pages at Turn Corner Pod. I was like, and then you put the stat out. He's plus three defensive run saves. And then he made that play today, honestly, probably like the highlight of the game. I guess you could put Riley Green's home run in there, but the highlight of the game is, you know, he has the presence of mind to throw home on, you know, another team with an overly aggressive third base coach and get a runner out that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I guess didn't like matter, but still was like kind of showed his A, IQ, B, ability. And that's about as long a throw as you're going to have as an infielder, right? So I was impressed. And I put it on X. I was like, are we prepared to say, like, is he good defensively? Because, you know, what is good? I don't know. But, like, we were kind of, we as fans and media were curious about, like, would he be passable at second base? Would he be manageable at second base? I think some people were prepared for. I'm not just like okay with his defense. I'm actually kind of impressed. Like, yeah, there's still a couple things like he kind of wish maybe his hands were a little quicker here, a little quicker there. So I don't want to say like I'm not saying he needs to like make some room on a mantle or anything for some hardware. However, I think he's good. I think he's good. Like, I am legitimately not worried right now about his defense. Not worried.
Yeah, I keep getting put on the spot, you know, are things good? I'm not ready to declare Colt Keith a good second baseman in comparison to the rest of Major League Baseball, but right now he certainly looked passable with the potential to be better than passable. The stats reflect it, like you said, 3 defensive runs saved, 1 outs above average. You know, that play in today's game, not only the presence of mind, one, just he got to the ball. And he had the willingness to get to the ball rather than just be like, oh, it's through the infield or whatever. You know, he slid and caught it so deep in the grass, he had no chance to make a play. But he happened to pursue the ball to get himself there, and then just happened to have a chance to throw out a runner at the plate because of it. I thought that was great. You know, I think probably his best play ended one of the games in Chicago. It ranged one to slow roller, the little glove flip to Torkelson. Almost got overshadowed because it was the end of the game. There was a lot of other storylines going on. It was very similar to the ball that Torkelson didn't go to in the opener. And we then later found out he was told, hey, let the second baseman have that ball. So similar play comes around. Colt Keith goes and gets it, makes an athletic play. Having mostly played third, short, I doubt he's glove flipped to first much in his life. You know, he did it and looked pretty natural. Me being a guy, you know, infielder when I played ball, like to nitpick some infield, you know, there was a double play ball, I think it was in New York, where he was really slow on the exchange and looked like he was going to give kind of a hard sidearm toss, ended up gathering and giving a slow underhand toss, and they didn't turn the double play. There was a steal attempt where he was set up too far in front of the base, didn't apply the tag very quickly. There's some little nitpick things that maybe the average Joe fan wouldn't notice that I have seen from Keith at second base that's not perfect, but his range has looked adequate. He's been plenty adept at making the routine plays. He's even made a couple plus plays so far, better than I expected. I think you got to feel pretty good about where he's at right now.
The range thing is probably the most impressive to me because, like, all we know him is this, like, bashing hitter, big athlete, and then you take him away from a corner, that's, like, the number one concern is the range element to it. So, like, I'm thoroughly impressed with that, and, you know, the bat will, he's like a lot of guys on this team in the order, where it's like, well, you're anticipating, expecting, banking on in a way, you know, the bat continuing to get better. He's far from the only guy cold, although he has had some moments, don't get me wrong. Yeah, but he's far from the only guy cold.
If we were to if we were to power rank hitters, there are some who I would put lower than him right now. Like, I think his approach has been solid. He's had a couple good swings. Clearly going to take a little bit of warming up here, but nothing is, like, causing me dismay that I've seen from Cole Keith at the plate.
Well, probably the best element there is that you kind of feel the same about him as you do, like, Green and Torque in a way, which those guys have, you know, belts on the wall, you know?
Yeah.
So, like,
I
mean,
I feel better about his at-bats than I have Torque so far right now. And Torque's had a few knocks as well, but Torque's also kind of this reoccurring symptom of last year where his timing is just off and he's late and he's late and he's late. It's like, all right, come on, let's get to the fastball. And once Torque started doing that last year, you know, he didn't really look back, but we're kind of in that spot again, waiting to see that from Spencer right now.
Yeah, and, you know, he did just miss one today. Well, it was today, right? He just missed one.
Right after Riley's homer. Riley's had some just ugly, ugly swings. He's also got three bombs, so, you know, he'll take it. You want to see him get a little more ironed out and consistent as well.
Well, let's... I had a Riley thought. I was texting with a buddy, and I was like, you know, like, this is just a pure observational, anecdotal thing, but I just kind of don't love his pitch selection. Is that... Do you think that's fair?
He has had some bad at-bats. He has had some at-bats where he did not get a good pitch to hit, or I think a couple times even he's been in an advantage count and swung at a pitch that wasn't really a hitter's pitch. He has not been doing himself any favors. I think the reason some of his swings have looked ugly, he hasn't been swinging at very good pitches, and he's kind of getting pounded soft away because he's really spinning pretty far out on his front foot some of the time. But I think that's a spot on take. I think Riley Green would tell you that that's a spot on take. You know, Riley can be pretty hard on himself, knows when he doesn't get a good pitch to hit. Easier said than done, obviously. So, you're definitely onto something there.
Yeah, and, you know, like, the hitters as a whole, like, you just look at the run output. It's not great, obviously. You know, a lot of times these past, you know, again, it's only 9 games. But it kind of brought me back to last year where, you know, like, the joke was, hey, you know, could Fetter and Lund, they have expertise in the batter's box too? Like, you know, trying to create this, like, hitting infrastructure to mirror the pitching infrastructure that you have. We talked about it, you've written about it, how, like, the hitting coaches is just, you know, it's just a job to get fired by, you know. It's kind of like, and it's also like the offensive coordinator in football, where everybody thinks they could figure out a way to call a better play, or in this case, like, instruct somebody how to hit. So I'm not criticizing these guys in any way, but in terms of, like, we talked about it at the beginning of this pod, expected outcomes, like, you kind of knew the bats were going to start out cold, but when you almost go shut out for 2 straight games to end a week, it's hard to not think about the 5-run extra inning that you had in New York earlier. You know what I mean?
That's kind of why I'm still feeling kind of positive about this team, because you've had this stretch of games where you did not hit at all and you won 6 of them. Okay, so what happens when you do start hitting? That should bode well for you. They could be worse than 6-3 right now, obviously.
Well, let's go to speaking of, could it be worse? Let's go to the worst aspect of the team in terms of the discussion surrounding it. So I'm not saying the guy's the worst. Javier Baez.
Remember opening day? Javi had a good game.
I know. He was Javi for a second. Right. He won a game, basically. Like, Javi... Like,
already
Javi
feels like last season. He hasn't done much of anything positive since that. I mean, defense has been fine, but at the plate, what are we doing here?
Well, okay. I actually kind of intended this week to, like, watch... Obviously, I'm watching all the games, but, like, watch every pitch that he takes, like that is like not like takes as in doesn't swing, but like takes as in thrown to him, and like count leg kicks and non-leg kicks. And I didn't get around to it, but it seems pretty random.
And forth depending on how hard Javi wants to hit the ball and then he giving it that. I don't know. Any given pitch.
Well, to be honest, okay, so this is just anytime he did the, you know, the toe tap or, you know, the twist or whatever it technically is called, I never really thought he was anchoring well to get anything behind the ball should he make, you know, like actual good barrel contact. So then I'm like, all right, so he obviously got coached on this adjustment and he's trying to do it. I assume he's working on it on the tee and in batting practice and all that stuff. It doesn't feel good, like, to me, like, watching. And so at least when he had the leg kick, you felt like it had some momentum behind it, right? So I don't know what the fix is. I don't know if anybody does. Maybe there is no fix. But it's ugly, and he was not in the lineup today, which kind of prompted, like, a lot of, like, some people were saying he was, quote-unquote, benched. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's... it's not good right now, Cody. And if you're one of those people that's looking for alternatives, I understand. But the whole point of the Javier Baez thing is like, what do you do? That why is he even here in the first place? Because you had nobody at that position, right? And like, what do? If you were a Kreider guy, he just got hit by a pitch. He's on the injured list. I don't, you know, we'll see how long that lasts. Hopefully he's healthy, you know, gets healthy quick. And then Eddie's Leonard, I don't know if he actually got hurt, but he had an awkward kind of falling swing that didn't look great. So I don't know if there's been an injury report that's come out on that. And so if you don't want Javier in the lineup, you kind of get what you get today. It's like you're getting Zach McKinstry. And like Zach's fine, but we know what happens when you play him too much. We saw it last year. You know, like I like Zach McKinstry, but he's not like part of a long-term solution here. So I don't know. I don't know. What do you think?
It's not a good situation, man. Like, I don't know that I have a lot more to add because we've been talking about it so much over the past year and talked about it all off season. Go on Javi's StatCast page right now for the 2024 season. That's already very, very blue. It's bluer than the Joni Mitchell album. Like, it's it's not good. I guess you just keep hoping he plays good defense and you get... a couple more of those opening day type moments every now and then. I do think his playing time will wane some if his production doesn't pick up. But that, for now, just means more McKinstry because you don't have a better option. Even the favorites of Tigers Twitter might be hurt now, so I don't know who they're going to turn to next. But it's troublesome. It's troublesome when he comes up and you just don't feel like there's any confidence. Surely his teammates in the dugout, you know, they'll never be able to admit it, but you know they got to be feeling the same way. You know, if you've ever played on a team and this guy comes up who you just kind of know isn't going to help your team, that's what Javi Baez has become in the batter's box. That's not good for a guy that, you know, you're paying $98 million over the next 4 years. We tend to be more positive about Javier than most people here on this pod, but I'm at the point where it's like, I just think he probably is what he is at the plate. You hope he can tap into some power, but it's been a long time since we've seen actual power out of the bat of Javier Baez. It's a bad situation. I don't think there's really an alternative, though. This is, Tigers are kind of stuck with it at least for the time being, at least for the 2024 season.
Yeah, and at least there is like a redeeming quality of the glove. Like, I don't want to take
the glove's been good. Hey, the throws have been good. Now that is kind of becoming like too much of the narrative. Like, it's like the last year, like, oh, Twerk is having good at bats thing. Although that did prove to be like somewhat true. But now it's like, oh, well, Javi's making good throws. It's like, well, he is, but you know, that only goes so far. But you'll take, I mean, that's what we've talked about though, for the past year, resetting expectations. Javier Baez can be a plus defender and do a little bit at the plate. Like, I don't know, would you rather have him or Nico Goodrum? Like, you would take Javi Baez and the potential Gold Glove caliber defense, although Nico Goodrum was a Gold Glove vote getter once, that was weird. But anyway, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, and to me, like, I do appreciate, and it's one of those things where you got to look at actions over words. I do appreciate that the team structure is not pretending that Javier is Javi, right? Has he batted higher than 7th or 8th? No. So, like, he is positioned in a way that, like, matches his output, per se, right? And then you could even argue, like, not having him in the game today was kind of one of the first instances of kind of not kid-gloving the situation. I'm not saying, like, kid-gloving Javi, because I think AJ's a pretty honest guy. I assume he's honest with the guys in the clubhouse. But, like, not kid-gloving the situation, whereas, like, how many times did you or your fellow beat writing partners have to say, because you were told, like, this is a scheduled day off for Javier Baez on, what was it, Wednesday or whatever. Like, how many times, like, it had to be, like, a thing that was put out there by the team so as to not create a firestorm of, quote-unquote, he's being benched. And then today, it was just like, yeah, he's not in the lineup.
Yeah, I don't know that he's, like, being benched, but I think he's certainly not guaranteed to be in the lineup every day anymore. I do think, like, the main reason he didn't play, AJ felt he needed to get McKinstry in for a day. And now, shortstop, with the lack of production from Javi, might be the most logical place to put in McKinstry, you know, more often than not. So, doesn't surprise me. We could see more of it. I wouldn't, like, blow it out of proportion. It's like it's a benching or whatever, but it is a sign that the days of Javi being guaranteed to be in the lineup are over. You know, he's not going to be treated differently than, like, the Matt Vierling, Andy, but, like Riley and Torque are really the only guy, and, like, I guess Canna, like, those are maybe Cole Keith, like, those are the guys who are kind of your locks, and the others, like, it depends by the day.
Yeah, and again, like, I appreciate the honesty in action and not trying to pretend something is what it isn't. I will say, you know, we talked about the pitching free agent additions, and, you know, we'll just say, like, lukewarm two starts in, you know, like, you know, maybe worse or whatever for those guys in terms of, like, perception of how from the fans and how they've done and then the actual results. But I think it's important to give some flowers to the additions of Mark Canna and Gio Urshela, who had,
pretty,
you know, he
nice
was
little player so far.
Both of them were heroes on Thursday as well. And I think, you know, like, there's, I enjoy watching Mark Canna play baseball more than I ever really thought, because he's just such a, like, he just has, like, a ball player's mold. And I don't know if that even makes sense, but it's like, I don't know if, like, some of these guys, you look at him, you're like, I could see him playing basketball, I could see him playing football. I don't know if I could see Mark Canna playing any other sport. I just feel like he's built for baseball.
He is a compliment. Yeah.
Like, and he's so nonchalant, and that's what, like, in some of his demeanor stuff. So that's what made the home run and, like, you know, looking out in the crowd and all that stuff so surprising to me, because there was, I can't remember if it was against New York or Chicago, but there was like a pass ball and, like, a runner, like, came home, and or wild pitch, whatever they technically called it. And I don't know if he even, like, he took maybe, like, one step back to give the runner a lane. Like, it was just like, you know, here you go, guy. Like, it was almost like, you know, sometimes in that situation, you get back, you're looking, you're kind of being the base coach, get down, you know, whatever. And he was just kind of like, yeah. You know, I just found that humorous. And then he has the home run, obviously Gio. So you wrote about this, you know, after opening day. I think we underrated, we as fans, we as people who talk about the team, maybe underrated, like, we knew the team was going to have to rely on pitching, right? That was a given, and it was said many times. I think we might have underrated, like, the steady veteran aspect of production, not, like, you know, clubhouse savvy, you know, that kind of thing. Although I'm sure that's, you know, playing it out too. But I think we underrated, like, all right, the young guys are going to go through some young guy struggles, and you're going to have a game where Mark Hanna hits a huge home run, and then like Gio comes up with an opposite field double that like more or less wins the game, you know? Like, I think that was, I think we underrated that aspect of how this team was constructed.
Yeah, I mean, Gio Urshela, remember he had a slow first 2 weeks of spring training and everyone was like ready to write him off. Like, the demise of Gio Urshela was greatly exaggerated. He has been a nice little player through 10 games here. His third base defense, pretty good, right? Like, the guy can make some plays over there. He's been steady with the bat, has like a consistent plan and approach. Look, he's not going to wow anybody at the plate, but so far, like, he seems steady and he goes up there and he puts the ball in play and he can make some contact. Like, I so far really like what Gio Urshela brings to the table. I'm not sure how it's going to translate analytically. Like, he's probably not going to be a 3-4 win player or anything, but you see ways that he can help the team win. You see ways his presence has some value. I'm actually writing, talk to Gio a little bit more. Like, this guy fractured his pelvis. Just not a baseball injury. It's literally a car accident injury. And I talked to Gio about that and we'll have a story on The Athletic later this week. Just kind of reflecting on like how wild and impactful of an injury this guy suffered last year. Of course it was going to be a little bit of a slow ramp back to play. Now that he seems settled and in the groove, I don't know. Feel pretty good about Gio Urshela through 10 games.
What did you make of that play today where he and was there an explanation given post game or not? So basically he fields a ball and it looks like he's going to go home and then he decides to throw to first and it's too late basically. So you get no out, you get no run prevention there. I'm just kind of curious, you know, I respect your infield opinions and, yeah, and theories as much as anybody. So
you know, I do. I think he didn't feel like he had a throwing lane to home. That's pretty much what AJ Hinch said after the game. When I saw the play, I wanted to, like, I wish I could go down on the field and, like, see what Gio saw. It was actually a mistake by the Oakland base runner. You know, the Tigers teach their base runners grounder to the left side, and you're on third, run in the grass so that it limits the fielder's throwing lane to home. Well, the A's guy was on the far side of the dirt. But because Gio caught the ball with his momentum going a little bit toward the third base side, did he actually, you know, did that help or hurt his throwing lane? He wasn't able to really, like, set his feet, throw maybe kind of around that runner like he wanted to. I assume he thought that was going to be the play, looked at it, thought he couldn't make the throw. By the time he turned his attention back to first, it was too late. So obviously not what you're looking for kind of in that situation where once you think about going home, you maybe got to go home. But it was a little bit of a weird play overall. So I don't think that like makes Gio a bad defender.
There's some hot takes about after that play. That was,
yeah,
like,
I almost wish, I mean, I don't know if he look, throwing the ball at the runner's back doesn't do you any good. So that's not what you want. But I almost wish he would have tried to make the throw to the plate.
Well, I want to harken back to my opener for you, Cody, even though he was in the news again today. Did anyone tease AJ about not getting ejected against the Mets there after the torque? Did he, you know, roll the swing, hit by the ball, like, you know, all that stuff? I think in a week that maybe like had less storylines, we probably would like talk about this more. We're just now getting into it and we're in the home stretch of this podcast here. I was thoroughly confused watching it on TV, and then like, because it looked like he called foul ball, Angel did, and this is bases loaded, Torque's at the plate, Tigers are up by 3, I believe, and you know, obviously trying to add more there against the Mets. And this is the first half of the doubleheader. It looked like he said, like, it hit, like, the knob or something. It's kind of what I interpreted Angel's statement. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess they're reviewing it to whether it was foul ball or hit, you know, hit Torque's hand. And then they converge. It seems like they talk to somebody because you got earpieces in, the umpires do. And then they just kind of, there wasn't even, I don't even think there, maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, Cody, I don't think there was even a an announcement made, like, on the microphone call as to whether, like, you know, what the real, all of a sudden you just see Angel Hernandez kind of do, like, the batting motion and the strike motion, and then AJ comes out and is all kinds of confused. And I really thought we were going to get our first AJ Hinch ejection of the year, because obviously it's not reviewable whether he had a strike or whether he swung or not. And AJ's like, what, you can't, like, appeal that? And AJ, it's not AJ, I'm sorry, Angel. It's beyond unfathomable that on that play, a major league umpire could say he swung and I don't need an appeal to the to one of the base umpires, in this case the first base umpire. It's unfathomable that on that play you could rule it that way. Now, if you wanted to say, like, you called it in the moment because, like, you thought it was a foul ball, I'd be like, okay, yeah, those plays are close. Sometimes you can't even tell. I don't even know if that guy was hit today, that Oakland hitter. Like, the replay didn't really look like much. But to say that he swung, I'm shocked that AJ in that moment did not get ejected, because that would lend itself to, that was an ejectionable offense by Angel Hernandez, I guess is how I'll summarize it.
Yeah, that was one of those weird plays where you almost have, like, a better vantage and perspective at home, like, watching on TV than I did at the park, because it was late in the game, and you got a doubleheader, there's a lot going on. I kind of watched it and was like, what's going on? What's he arguing about? Oh, is he going to get tossed? Okay, he didn't get tossed. I'm scrambling, trying to, like, work on the story or figure out what happened next. So I didn't have too passionate of a take in the moment, and then we didn't talk to AJ until after the doubleheader, so I think he had settled down about it by the time we asked him. Just based on his reaction, AJ does not get that heated very often, based on how he appeared on the field. I was like, oh, he's going to get tossed. It's going to be funny because he's going to get tossed for like 5 minutes and then they're going to start a new game. Maybe that's why they didn't toss him. I don't know.
Well, you could argue it was like the perfect time to get tossed because, you know, you had a lead, you know, like a nice lead, I guess. I know it's not insurmountable or anything. It's still a safe situation, but you had a lead and you just go in the dugout, have a coffee, and then, you know, you kind of get a head start on the next game's lineup, you know. Like, you could argue that was a perfect situation. And again, it was 100% warranted. And I think Angel, did you see what he did today?
No, I saw some more complaints on Twitter. I didn't even see the call.
So there was there was two. There was one where a pitcher stepped off the rubber, threw a ball. It was high above the strike zone, noticeably high. And not only was it deemed a legal pitch, it was deemed a strike, and I think it was a strike out for the Yankees hitter. I can't remember who was, and maybe it was Torres. I can't remember who was at the plate at the time. And then he also just had, like, a ball that was, like, middle-middle that he called the ball. Like, a pitch that was middle-middle, he just called the ball. It's, like, it's amazing.
You know, some people are saying, like, how does Angel Hernandez still have a job? It's a great bit. Like, it's kind of a great bit. I respect it. I mean, I wouldn't like it if I'm on the field and he's making the call against my team, but just as a neutral observer, like, what a great side plot line. Like, every now and then, Angel Hernandez just appears with a totally ridiculous call. I think it's great.
He's the Scott Foster of Major League Baseball. I mean, if even Manfred was on one of the FS1 shows earlier this week, and the guy's like, so you're going to get the ABS, or not the ABS, automated strike zone. Is that called the Angel Hernandez? He was asked. And Manfred handled it well, which obviously he doesn't handle all media all that well. But yeah, so, I mean, that in terms of weird things that happened to the Tigers, we barely even got to it. But that was certainly something. And had they lost that game, that would have been a huge storyline. All right, well, I think it's about as good a time as any to wrap up this pod. I do want to say from Cody and myself, thank you to everybody who submitted. We call it a tip. We call that a tip on. Call it a tip on Venmo. We very much appreciate it. That was very, very absolutely gracious of those that did so. And I want to reiterate, you're going to get tired of me saying this throughout the season, but, you know, we're we're on the socials, people. Now we've expanded. We got Instagram. We got, you know, obviously we're on YouTube. We're gonna do some. We're gonna do more YouTube exclusives as well, and we're on the TikTok. So in addition to X, formerly known as Twitter, at Cody Stavenhagen, I am at Kieran underscore Steckley, and our pod page is at Turn Corner Pod. So anything else, Cody, before we get out of here?
No, just a reminder, if you're interested in advertising with Turning the Corner, we've had a little bit of interest, but that opportunity certainly remains on the table. So if you own or involved in a local business or know someone who might be interested in advertising with our pod, we would love it. You can hit us up on the tip jar to help us keep this thing going. We do it for free. Right now, that's TTC-pod on Venmo. And then we have the merch store linked in our social media bios. You can get the all-important Turning the Corner koozie right there. We've had some sales there as well. Give me some feedback on the merch for those of you who have ordered it. Let me know how it turned out, if we need to make any alterations there. But otherwise, as always, appreciate the listener support. We've already had some ups and downs in this early season, and no doubt we got more to come.
Couldn't have said it better myself. So reminder, follow us on all those socials and subscribe on YouTube so we can continue to grow this. And we appreciate everybody's support, financial or otherwise, because we couldn't do this without each and every one of you. So for Cody Stavenhagen, I am Kieran Steckley. Everybody have a great day.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.